Thank you for coming again. This is my third lecture. Most likely you already get bored, but I have no choice. Actually, I have to continue. I think I'll stay with my electrochemical interfaces, but this time I am going to focus on oxygen electrochemistry. As I said last time, for the hydrogen reaction, again, everything what I'm going to talk about basically is going to be centered on this right-hand side. Although this time I'm not going to constantly repeat actually of important about electrochemical interfaces per se, but rather how the structure and nature of electrochemical interface actually make control activity, stability, and this time I'm also going to talk about selectivity. More or less, we know how to make active materials. We are learning how, basically, to make stable materials. I am afraid we know the least about selectivity, and I think maybe this is a direction which at least I would like to go. As I said, in my presentation, I would like first somehow to make oxygen in electrolyzers, and then I would try really to utilize oxygen in fuel cells, hopefully, to get very, very hot electrons. So as I said last time, my strategy, at least long-term strategy, was always to try to understand processes at atomic and molecular levels, and then basically to apply the knowledge in the real research. Let me briefly summarize, again, just to remind you what we've been talking the last, actually, three lectures. The first, I spent some time somehow at least focusing on electrochemical interfaces, trying to convince you how important is the structure of electrode materials, but also not only how the structure can determine covalent interaction basically or between electrode and adsorbates, but also how these strong adsorbates somehow may change the structure. I think the beauty of all of these covalent interactions is not just changing the surface structure, but also changing, for example, the structure of electrode, but also changing the structure of the double layer through whatever I call non-covalent actual interactions. And mostly these interactions are van der Waals type of forces. Please keep in mind that every of these adsorbates, somehow the energy of adsorption or heat of adsorption, or in electrocatalysis or in catalysis, basically reactivity of these species strongly depends on the coverage. And I think electrochemists usually forgot this, especially electrochemists who are working for oxygen reduction and oxygen evolution reaction. That, for example, the adsorption of oxygen tremendously, actually, the heat of adsorption is going down simply by increasing the coverage by oxygenated species. And I think this is going to be very important. This is certainly very important also for the kinetics, which, for example, I try to emphasize that there are two key species at the interfaces. One, what we call promoters, which basically are activating the rate determining step. But also, there are spectators. And more, basically, I start appreciating spectators. And I think if you don't understand spectators, it would be impossible to guess what may or may not happen with promoters. So this, somehow, the interplay between promoters and spectators, I try, for example, to lead you through my hydrogen story. It is very important to know the pH-dependent kinetics of the hydrogen reaction. Not because pH, but rather because in alkaline solution, basically, in order to make hydrogen, for example, from water, you have to learn how to split the water molecules. And this might be actually the prelude for whatever I am going to discuss today about splitting the water, for example, in electrolyzer and making not hydrogen, but oxygen. Certainly, what basically on the end I was trying to emphasize is basically that more or less we know how to make active, but we don't know how to make stable materials. So more and more I am going to talk about the balance between activity and stability. And I think, as we discussed this morning, it's not really just for fuel cells or electrolyzers, but I think the balance in activity and stability actually may also determine the future of the battery systems. Now, Today I'm going to, as I said, I'm going to focus on the oxygen story. I'm going to stay with my actually schematics, just emphasizing, for example, that besides hydrogen reaction, which is taking place in this potential range, we also, for example, spent a lot of time learning about the oxygen electrochemistry. In fact, any time when we are talking about hydrogen economy, we should keep in mind that hydrogen economy basically is determined with oxygen reaction, not with the hydrogen. More or less, hydrogen reaction is very fast. So we don't need really to invest too much, especially in acidic medium. Now, as I said, first think what I'm going to do. I'm going, for example, to somehow to involve oxygen, which is taking place in electrolysis. But this process is not just process in electrolysis, but also, for example, in many of these metal air batteries, metal deposition processes. And then once I have oxygen, I'm going to try to reduce the oxygen in fuel cells. But again, this process is common again in batteries, for example, corrosion, peroxide production, as well as, for example, if you use depolarized electrode for chlorine production. So this is what I'm going to try to do today, for example, and the goal is going to be the same. Can we really, based on the knowledge, can we really, based on atomic and molecular level information, create cost-effective, active, and stable materials? And certainly what we would like, to be pH universal. In order to do this, for example, at least, as I said, we have to resolve processes at atomic and molecular levels. If we would like to claim that we are really designing or tailoring something, and in the, fortunately, many papers we always see in the title, tailoring, designing. But I think without this, it would be very difficult to claim that we can do this. What basically I'm going to try to do, I'm going to try to use, again, my surface science approach in order to see how production of oxygen I can move as close as to the reversible potential for oxygen reaction, as well as for oxygen reduction reaction, how basically to be as close as to 123 volt. And this is the whole thing what I'm going to do today. I'm going to try to move this, for example, this curve left and right in order to maximize the energy what I can gain from the fuel cells or from the electrolyzers. Now, as I said, we are doing processes at atomic and molecular levels. Now, if you look at, for example, this is platinum-111 single crystals. And clear, there is no ideal single crystals. And many, many people also don't, for example, even consider that even less there are real nanoparticles. Usually nanoparticles in the size range, at least what, for example, let's say in fuel cells, around 5 nanometers. So we should keep in mind that, for example, there are no ideal surfaces. On one side, for example, we can, for example, suffer for this somehow inhomogeneity. But on the other side, without these defects, maybe our whole reaction would be actually locked. Now, usually people are saying, but why I'm spending so much time trying to learn from single crystals? I try to convince them that the knowledge is on this side. Without basically knowing what is going on single crystals, I wouldn't be able to resolve any of the challenge which we are facing, for example, with real nanoparticles. That's the reason why somehow I'm trying to go around from knowledge to challenge and back. For many reactions, including the oxygen evolution reaction. Now, in the literature, as I said in my first lecture, for example, you can find many, many descriptors, many, for example, sub-equations which are trying to explain, for example, the reaction mechanism. I don't like to discourage you, but I'd like to tell you it's very difficult to talk about the reaction mechanism. How you can talk about the reaction mechanism when you basically, let's say with real nanoparticles, when you know very little about the structure, when you know very little about, for example, surface properties, and not even mentioning the double layer properties. So only what, for example, I'm going to try to do today, rather than to talk about the reaction mechanisms, I'm going to apply my surface science approach in order to be able to demonstrate, for example, that materials design can come also only from this knowledge side. I'm going to discuss today a little bit about noble oxide, ruthenium and iridium, but also I'm going to mention some of our new results, which are correlating with osmium and iridium. Then certainly I'm going to touch 3D transition metal oxides. Lots of people today, including in this group, are talking about perovskites. I'm also going to show some of our actually perovskite data, just to give you a flavor, for example, that in fact, there are really no differences. You can use whatever you want. But the basic principles, more or less, at least how I see, are almost the same. And now, certainly, electrochemists usually forgot that there are amorphous and crystalline structures. They would just, at least in electrocatalysis, they would just synthesize materials and to test without really being aware what kind of crystal structure we are talking about. And I think this is what is very important, and this is what I would like actually to start with. When we start doing oxides, for example, we again start using our iridium, for example, in this case is polycrystalline, but certainly we use also single crystals. And now what we know from, at least from electrochemistry, is it's very easy. This is what we call the cyclic voltammetry. And now this is the hydrogen adsorption, this is OH adsorption, and this is what we call irreversible oxide formation. Once you touch, for example, you can cycle between these two regions 1,000 times, nothing will change. Because this is more or less a reversible adsorption of OH on the surface. However, once you touch this irreversible part, or as we discussed the last two weeks, once you go above 3.6 volt actually in the lithium system, you basically are going to go from reversibility to irreversibility. So this is exactly what is happening in this potential. You start actually forming this amorphous oxide, which are hydroxyoxides, are really not oxides. But then if you make, for example, certainly in order to learn about different in catalytic activity between these amorphous electrochemically made oxides, and there are actually beautiful work with Mike Weaver, which unfortunately is not any longer with us. He spent a lot of time with Raman actually learning amorphous structures. And whoever likes to go in this direction, I would highly recommend his papers. But now, in order to try to see the difference in activity, we also make oxide with thermal, actually, approach in UHV. You can just put the same crystal heat a little bit and to put oxygen and to make iridium oxide. So what we really want, for example, to see the difference in catalytic activity, not only catalytic activity, but also in stability during oxygen evolution reaction. And we made gold the same way, we made platinum, iridium, we made ruthenium, but also we made electrochemically osmium. And now let me summarize very briefly what is correlation between activity and stability. I know that the slide is very busy, but I think it's very important. What I'm showing on the bottom part is really activity for the oxygen reduction reaction on amorphous, which is blue, and crystalline thermally made oxide, which are yellow, on gold, platinum, iridium, ruthenium, and osmium. What you can find, for example, keep in mind this is overpotential. So higher bar graph means less active. The least active is gold, and the most active is osmium. But now, if you look at stability for the same, for example, materials, you can see that the most stable is gold, the least stable is osmium. Again, this is whatever I was trying to talk about last time, that activity and stability for this type of reaction actually are going in opposite direction. And we have to be very careful actually claiming that we have active materials. We have to demonstrate that, in fact, we have active enough to sustain stability during the operation. So now, it's clear that there are these trends in activity and stability. Now, certainly the key, if you look at, for example, amorphous oxides are more stable but also less active because of defects. All of these amorphous oxides are much more defected, for example, than thermally prepared oxides. And I believe also on the surface, not just in the bulk. So I think defects, at least what, for example, we try to say in our paper, which which reviewers didn't actually appreciate very much, play a very, very important role. We had a very difficult time to publish this paper. I spent almost 1 year fighting with reviewers, actually, to convince them that there is this, for example, inverse order inactivity and stability. So this is, for example, in order to, there's a reason why in order to see what is really going with defects, we use the same tricks as usually. We, for example, compare ruthenium polycrystalline, which is full of defects, and ruthenium single crystal, which is much less defected surface, and the same with iridium. Now, let me briefly summarize, for example, what we see all of here. The blue is ruthenium, and you can see that ruthenium polycrystalline electrode is much more active than single crystal. But again, you can see that ruthenium polycrystalline electrode is much less stable, for example, than ruthenium single crystal. So again, there is this inverse, for example, proportionality in activity and stability. Certainly, the same apply for iridium. And the same apply if you would compare activity of any of these surfaces for ruthenium and iridium. That's the reason why I think don't focus only on activity. I think we simultaneously have to focus on stability of our materials in order to be able to claim that we are really designing new materials. Now, besides all of this activity stability, what at least we were interested, for example, is can we follow, for example, change in oxidation state?
And
this is with ICP, this is ex situ ICP, but I'm going to show you now in situ. We do oxygen, for example, and then we took oxygen evolution reaction, let's say for half an hour and 10 milliamps, and then we take for this experiment, we took, for example, a sample, and then we measure with ICP, for example, how much ruthenium or iridium you can find in solution.
You don't do long-term electrolysis and looking when?
I think sometimes half an hour is enough to see the trends. But now this is what we are trying to do, because once you hold that very positive potential, you may actually deactivate electrodes because you may make thick oxides. So this is also something. Now, I'm going to come back to this. But now how, for example, we can follow, is it possible to follow change and to correlate change in oxidation state of ruthenium or iridium and stability or, if you like, activity? Now, certainly with bulk electrodes, we cannot use X-ray absorption spectroscopy, but we learned and we spent a lot of time, for example, how to deposit, for example, thin films. I think, don't take my word, but I think around 10 atomic layers of iridium and ruthenium on glassy carbon. And then once we have this thin layer, now this is something certainly with X-ray absorption is bulk somehow techniques. So we are not claiming that we know what is at the surface. But what we were trying to do basically on this, you can see this normalized thickness of oxide. And don't ask me how, for example, our postdoc actually have done it. But he somehow, after XPS, his analysis basically tried to see how thick oxide, for example, you can find, or, for example, what is the oxidation state or the thickness of this oxidation state at certain potential. Certainly, when you start with ruthenium or iridium thin film at negative potential, oxidation state is zero. Suddenly, you see above 0.8 volt, you start seeing change in oxidation state, which is somehow approaching this 3 plus positive value. But then keep in mind the thickness, for example, of this state is much higher for ruthenium than iridium. Certainly because ruthenium or iridium is more noble than ruthenium. Now, if you go further, for example, you can see, especially above 1.4 volt, you see, for example, this huge increase, for example, in thickness for the oxide formation of ruthenium. I have no data here, but somehow we also learned that in this potential range, both iridium and ruthenium start dissolving. So what we propose, for example, is that really this transition for 4 plus to greater than 4 plus is affecting, for example, instability of ruthenium species. Now, again, how to make the balance between activity and stability of these two materials. And I think, at least in the past, many people were doing experiments with iridium ruthenium as a catalyst for oxygen evolution reaction. Certainly, we are not the first one. But what we really wanted, I wanted always to understand what is really the magic or what is behind ruthenium. And certainly, in many of the papers, almost all our authors suggested you have to add ruthenium into iridium in order, for example, to help electronically to improve electronic properties of iridium. Now, is this true or not? Let me, for example, summarize in my two slides. First of all, in order to learn about now ruthenium alloys, or for example, how these alloys can operate in real systems, instead of going immediately to high surface area materials, again, we basically start playing with thin films. And this is exactly what we've done. For example, before we start even doing anything with thin films, we did with our bulk electrodes. This is something, for example, we made 6 different iridium ruthenium actually alloys, from iridium being 20% in the bulk to 80% in the bulk, or certainly we also have a pure ruthenium and iridium samples. Now, keep in mind these are bulk electrodes. This is something we use the same trick actually for ruthenium platinum as a CO catalyst for hydrogen CO tolerance actually, which was fashionable 2 decades ago. Now, what I am trying to summarize here is, in UHV, for example, for all of these 6 alloys, first of all, we can see certainly what is in the bulk, but also we use ion scattering, which is the key to see what is on the surface. Catalysis certainly depends on the bulk, but mainly actually depends on the surface properties. So what we know, if we have sputtered surface in UHV, we know that exactly actually as much as we have in the bulk, we have also on the surface, and these are these gray dots. Let's say you have 20% in the bulk ruthenium, and you have 20% ruthenium on the surface. Most likely, you forget, but in my first lecture about the interfaces, I mentioned how important actually segregation process for bimetallic alloys. And this is also what we utilize. After sputtering, for example, then we annealed our sample. And for example, and this is segregation, is just enrichment of one element at the surface comparing to the bulk. And because of lower energy of iridium, for example, than surface energy than ruthenium, what we found after the annealing, for example, you see huge increase in iridium and basically decrease in ruthenium. So now what we have after annealing, we have bulk 50-50, but the surface is enriched with iridium. And now you can play, and we play basically, we spent a lot of time with all of these alloys, finding that bulk iridium ruthenium 50-50 is the most active material. Now, how we did all of this? First, we did voltammetry for all of this. This is just to show transition from voltammetry for ruthenium and iridium to ruthenium iridium. But then I think what was really the key is, again, to measure activity stability. Again, we are measuring activity without rotating disk electrode, and in this case, stability with amount of dissolved ruthenium or iridium after oxygen evolution reaction. What we found?
The CV doesn't tell much about the difference between the different materials.
I think if you look at, for example, let's say ruthenium, if you look at ruthenium, very small adsorption of hydrogen. So I know that, for example, and also you see also here very sort of this pseudocapacity, which, for example, if you look at for iridium, it's very tiny one. Now, if you look at for iridium, you have a much more hydrogen than for ruthenium. And now when you have ruthenium iridium, you can see it's really, the voltammetry is really in between these two. Even if you look at oxide formation, look at how much oxide you are forming on ruthenium, because it's very oxophilic. Very little oxide on ruthenium. And just in the middle between for 50-50, you see much more oxide because also you may have some ruthenium on the surface. Now, for activity stability, I don't like somehow to repeat myself, basically what we found is that, first of all, iridium is the least stable. Keep in mind this is over potential. But it is the least active, but is the most stable. Ruthenium is the most active, but the least stable. Now, if, for example, I would see what is activity of sputter versus annealed surface, what we found that sputter surface is a little bit more active, but much more unstable. So what basically happened, what basically based on this and many, many more experiments, what we found that if you have ruthenium, for example, 50-50, what is happening that during the oxygen evolution reaction, ruthenium is slowly dissolving. So on the end, you end up with this, what we call iridium skeleton. I'm going to demonstrate this more clearly, actually, with iridium osmium system. So this is something also what is very important. Although we have the same bulk, we have completely different surfaces and certainly completely different, somehow, a ratio between activity and stability. What about thin films? Again, we use these very thin films, and now this is 50-50 ruthenium iridium. And we were, again, using spectroscopy, trying to see how basically now ruthenium and iridium in alloy are changing the oxidation state. And again, what we found, initially, for example, let's say certainly we found that more ruthenium is oxidized than iridium, and then you go more and more, and everything is fine until 1.3 volts, where, for example, this huge change in oxidation state for iridium is observed. And then suddenly you see that you are forming more iridium oxide than ruthenium oxide. How is this possible? At least the only way is that ruthenium, actually, this potential, as we say, is somehow corroding from the surface, leaving behind the skeleton. So now what we see more iridium oxide than ruthenium oxide. At least this is how we try to explain, for example, all of this transition in the oxidation state and how basically we are somehow at least proposing our schematics for formation of iridium skeleton. Now, activity stability, again, I don't like to waste of time, is absolutely the, is everything follows basically what we found for our bulk electrodes. More somehow annealed surface is less active but much more stable. In fact, this is one of the most stable, actually, ruthenium iridium electrodes we ever find for the oxygen evolution reaction. So I think it is, my message is not only just synthesizing materials and trying really to see activity, but pay attention on stability, but also pay attention on change in electronic properties and how these electronic properties may affect actually interfacial properties in general. From all of this, it was very easy, although it's not learning actually that segregation is very important part in somehow designing, for example, this first what we call nano-segregated domains and designing the skeleton, we learn only based on the bulk electrodes. We would never be actually able to learn this from nanoparticles. Although based on this, certainly we designed the nanoparticles and we find absolutely the same as we find with the bulk electrodes. So only based on the knowledge on this side, we were able somehow really to make something ruthenium iridium annealed surface, which at least what we found in the literature is absolutely the best ruthenium iridium alloy for oxygen evolution reaction. Certainly, I think this is, it would require much, much more time. But I think my message was really to give you a flavor, for example, that morphology is really very important, because what is really behind all of this is really not, ruthenium electronic effects are minor, almost doesn't, I don't think that they even contribute. What annealing is really doing, reorganizing surface atoms, and this is what is my skeleton. Certainly when you anneal, you increase the mobility of surface atoms, and then you make the structures, for example, which are much more stable, for example, than the structure which would be formed simply by synthesizing and dealloying ruthenium iridium sample. Now, all of this was, for example, and all of this activity stability, somehow we were measuring by by ex situ ICP-MS. Let me very briefly also saying that, just to repeat that, we can do now this in situ. And I'm not going to go again. For example, this is just two examples for platinum-111 and platinum-100. We can follow oxygen evolution, and simultaneously we can follow, for example, dissolution of surface atoms, parts per trillion. It's very, very sensitive method. Now, based on this method, we were thinking how now we can, for example, extend our first graph, and how basically we can learn, for example, based on this methodology, to try to see, can we really tune activity and stability based on the balance which are required for optimizing materials. In order for this, I'm just going now to focus on iridium and osmium. We still didn't publish this paper, but for example, we submitted. And I think the beauty of ICP-MS in situ, this is rotating disk electrode, and this is our probe, which can in situ, for example, take, for example, dissolve either iridium or ruthenium, and to measure simultaneously during oxygen evolution reaction. But right now, I think, I don't know how many of you are familiar with B-alloy. At least in the catalysis, it's becoming very, very fashionable way how to make high surface area materials. You have two, this is usually for bimetallic or multimetallic alloys. You have multimetallic components, and during, for example, let's say oxidation processes, less, for example, noble would first corrode, leaving behind something, for example, which may have unique catalytic properties. In the case of iridium and osmium, what we find certainly, the dissolution of osmium is huge. It's almost three orders of magnitude higher than for iridium during the dealloying. Now, what we basically did, we are now keeping the constant current density, and we are, let's say, maybe 1 milliamps per square centimeter. And now we are measuring sort of corrosion of simultaneously, actually, corrosion of osmium and iridium. And this is the beauty, simultaneous. Is not first osmium and then iridium. Now, and this is something also, I think I'm not going to go into this dealloying business, but this is very important because there are many theories which are trying to explain dealloying based on just calculations and not on experimental results. What we found from experiment, depending on the ratio between iridium and osmium, one can leave behind various actually porous structures. But what you see for this, all of these porous structures is unique, for example, now sort of cyclic voltammetry with this very reversible peak, which we assigned bravely actually to OH adsorption. Not only our group, but in general electrochemical community. Now, this is something you see that there is really no change in the position of the peak is the same. So there is no really change in any kind of electronic properties. Only what is different, certainly, is the surface area between this, for example, dealloy system and this dealloy system. And now, certainly, this with having much higher concentration of iridium, 75%, you form a huge electrochemical surface area. And I'm going to discuss about this, how important basically is to delineate electronic morphological effects. Before I do this, let me just briefly again summarize that now we can do simultaneously oxygen evolution and dissolution of either iridium bulk or iridium alloy. And again, we know something. During oxygen evolution reaction, you always see dissolution of material. So it is really true that surface during oxygen evolution reaction, even on noble materials, is constantly evolving. And I think this is what we should keep in mind. And this is why we should somehow remind our DFT colleagues. Keep in mind that somehow the surface is not really rigid. It's constantly changing. So please provide me first information about stability and then about activity. Now, what I would like to mention for all of this, you see that iridium 25, osmium 75, the onset for oxygen evolution is shifted almost 300 millivolts. And certainly one can say, oh, this is the most active materials because now osmium is providing somehow unique electronic properties to iridium, which in fact is not true. If you would, for example, now normalize active surface area, you would find that basically activity of bulk iridium and this high surface area material is absolutely the same. So the only trick is not changing electronic properties, but rather changing in morphology. But also, as I said, it's not only activity. What about ratio between activity and stability? And I think this is what, for example, I was very happy to see, that the ratio between activity and stability, which we are calling activity stability factor, I have no time to go through this, is such, for example, that this factor is much higher for this alloy than for the bulk electrode. I'm not going to go through this. Certainly, we have plenty of time. We have 4 more days. If anyone would like to discuss about this, certainly I'd be very happy. Only what the message is, don't pay attention only on activity. Try to find the ratio between activity and stability in order to be able to claim that you have really valuable catalyst for oxygen evolution reaction. Now, all of this, what I was discussing, is certainly for bimetallic alloys. Very quickly, what is happening now? Because I spent a lot of time discussing, for example, these systems in which on platinum or on gold we deposited this cobalt hydroxyoxide, and then it was very active for hydrogen evolution. The question is, what would happen if I would go from minus 0.1 volt to, for example, 1.5 volt where oxygen evolution is taking place? Now, with STM, we clearly see, once we go to high potential, you see sintering. So it's really not that you preserve these ad islands or these clusters are moving and making these larger clusters, which under our experimental conditions were very stable. And this is something what we are now using our in situ ICP to try to see how really this stable is. I don't know if you remember, most likely you forgot. If, for example, we will deposit, let's say, nickel hydroxyoxide, cobalt, iron, and all of this, we find trends in catalytic activity for hydrogen CO oxidation reaction. And everything trend basically was going, for example, that the most active was nickel hydroxyoxide. It's very interesting that now if you, for example, if you look at the trends, oxygen evolution reaction is also the most active for nickel hydroxyoxide and not for manganese hydroxyoxide. So you have completely 3 different reactions, but you have absolutely different, the same trends. So based on this, certainly I don't know, I never seen in my life, nobody actually seen OH, we somehow suggested what is common for all of these 3 reactions. Is for CO definitely is OH. For oxygen evolution reaction, if you are involving oxygen from alkaline solution, is OH. I try, for example, to convince you that splitting the water reaction, for example, in alkaline solution is also involving OH. So what is the common descriptor is OH. And that's the reason why, for example, we suggested that reaction basically might be very simple. You basically have adsorption of OH, and then almost like TAFEL, for example, in hydrogen reaction, you have recombination of 2 OH forming oxygen and involving water. So this is one example, for example, which clearly shows that somehow now we are making, we are trying actually to make this also real materials. But again, I would just, why this is important, because you see 3 different reactions and you see basically the same descriptor. And this is what I'm interested in right now. I'm not really interested because I know that I'm not going to be able to resolve reaction mechanism of any of these reactions, but at least my hope is that I can find the common descriptor. And based on common descriptor, really try to design the materials. Now, talking about activity and stability, let me finish with oxide, basically with perovskites. This is something, again, we spent a lot of time, for example, trying to deposit strontium-ruthenium oxide on strontium titanium oxide. And I have no time, but you can look at our paper, basically. It is very interesting. Again, my goal was to make single crystals. I know that there are many, many perovskite studies where people would make perovskites and do activity and basically then predicted what would be the most active site. In our case, for example, we really deposited strontium ruthenium oxide, but at least what we know for sure, we have nice bulk single crystals. How we know this? At least X-ray scatterers convinced me that these small wrinkles or somehow represent very good bulk structure. This is, for example, really, for example, the signature for STO. So we do have, for example, two completely, we have also the third one, completely bulked different structures. But if you look at the surface, because surface where catalysis is taking place, is completely different. It has really nothing to do with perfection. In fact, it's full of defects. So can you now, certainly we have this beauty, but also we have, and again, this is what we were discussing, this is God-given, and this is devil-provided, actually, surfaces. But again, we try to understand the electronic effects. We are coming to this pre-edge peak, which basically we spent a lot of time discussing yesterday. Now, for lithium, at least ruthenium is assigned to redox, for example. We find all of this, for example, if this is really oxygen redox, then certainly it's common also for strontium, ruthenium oxide. But not only this, we did many, many more characterization for these single crystals. Basically, what we basically were doing at that time, really to establish structure, activity, stability relationships. And long, long story, to make very short, less stable are more active. Ruthenium, for example, 111, with very, very somehow rough surface, is the most active but the least stable. Again, I have no doubt that density of defects are playing the role. Everyone is talking about defects, but at least we try to see them and really to correlate activity and stability with the defects. So all of this, for example, what I was discussing, and I'm afraid I won't have time for oxygen reduction reaction, but nevertheless, I wanted really somehow to from all of this to go back to the volcano landscape. This is something what I introduced in my first lecture. And this is what theory is predicting. This is what at least some of experiments are giving us. And they somehow try to convince us that they can, for example, find the descriptor. In one case, the substrate oxygen binding energy that control all of this. In another case, for example, that the most important is the occupancy of 3D surface orbitals with EG symmetry. Although I appreciate all of this, I would like to challenge them and just to ask them, provide me first, for example, stability of this system, and then we can discuss about the activity of your systems. Without this, I think, for example, it would be very, very difficult. But at least I am suspicious, and what we are trying maybe to do, to demonstrate that maybe this is really stability volcano rather than activity volcano. I'm not saying that I might be actually correct, but still, I strongly believe in our activity stability factor, the ratio between activity and stability, rather than slowly on activity to determine catalytic activity. So with this, let me briefly finish with somehow making the oxygen, and let me very briefly, because I don't know how much time I have, I lost the 15 minutes? Yeah, 15 is fine. The oxygen reduction reaction is closest to my heart. This is basically where I start my sort of learning, really, oxygen electrochemistry. And I was always somehow on one side puzzled, but on the other side very exciting about very somehow simple reaction, which again in the literature people are making so complex. This is one of the simplest schemes for oxygen reduction reaction in acid medium. Now, I remember when I was your age, we were sort of somehow really debating, is this sort of serious reaction pathway going from oxygen to water? Or you absorb oxygen, then you split the oxygen, and for example, then you have this direct four-electron path. I wasted a lot of my time, to be honest, really trying to make, and also we were including mobility of oxygen absorbed on the surface. In fact, I think reaction is very simple. Our lack of knowledge is making this reaction very complex. And this is really true. For example, if one can do rotating ring disk method the way how it should be done, somehow one can really find a common descriptor which can nicely explain, for example, what is happening during the oxygen reduction reaction in fuel cell systems. Now, what is very important to remember, at least for hopefully some of you would one day at least move from the battery field to electrocatalysis. So if you go, for example, into catalysis direction, keep in mind that oxygen reduction reaction is always taking place on surfaces which is covered, for example, with this what we call spectators. There is no free surface, neither platinum. And what you can look at, for example, that even hydrogen UPD is affecting activity. In fact, by monitoring formation of peroxide on this ring electrode, we can now really quantitatively follow formation of peroxide. And this is, I think, that was a big deal, because now we can quantify how much you're making peroxide and how much you go directly to the water, actually, molecules. Keep in mind that the reaction is starting when you start actually getting rid of this OH species on the surface. So this is really clear that somehow there is very unique correlation between the current, what we are measuring, and the coverage with spectator species. Certainly, in the literature, and always we should think about energy of absorption of reaction intermediates. But what is really driving the reaction? Is it my 1 minus theta or delta G term? This is what basically I was trying to do by changing electrolytes, sort of going from sulfuric to perchloric to chloride-containing solution, to learn that basically the coverage of these spectators more or less are somehow controlling the oxygen reduction activity. Now, certainly, oxygen reduction reaction, as almost every electrochemical surface process, is structure sensitive. You can see in 0.05 molar sulfuric acid, for example, clearly, the most active is 11110, but the least active is 111. Why? We propose because sulfuric acid anions with tetrahedrons are very strongly absorbed on this octahedron sites, for example, on 111. And that this somehow is really true, that these anions are controlling these trends. If you would go from sulfuric to, for example, KOH, then you suddenly find that in KOH, 111 is the most active surface. So it's really not the energy of absorption of reaction intermediates, but rather the surface coverage with spectators are determining activity of oxygen reduction reaction. And certainly I have a huge disagreement with my DFT colleagues, because of what they're really doing all the time. They're focusing on energy of absorption of reaction intermediates. Now, this is, for example, just to emphasize that oxygen reduction reaction is very simple, at least how I'm considering, is really somehow trying to understand how to optimize somehow availability of surface sites for molecular oxygen to come and to start proceeding the reaction. Now, let me somehow also activity. This is something which I'm not going to spend more than 30 seconds because I talk in my first lecture. This is just showing that, for example, during the oxygen reduction reaction, you have continuous change of the surfaces, especially if you go positive from 1.1 volt. So the surface is really alive, and we have to be very careful, for example, in thinking how to design the materials for oxygen reduction. It's not also, again, it's not just activity, but also stability. And this is really true. Now we can follow, for example, oxygen reduction reaction, let's say on 110, and to follow simultaneously, for example, dissolution of platinum during the oxygen reduction reaction. So keep in mind also that surfaces are alive. And although some people are saying, certainly when they put 1 kilo of high surface area materials on the electrode, oh, my electrode is stable because after 3 hours, current doesn't change. Current doesn't change, but slowly electrode is degrading. That's the reason why I think working with single crystals is very important, because this is really, as I said, part per trillion of platinum surface atoms. Now, why is this important? Because, as I said in my first lecture, because if we don't understand single crystals, I am doubting that we can understand the effect of nanoparticles. Because nanoparticles contains all of these facets, including 110 facet, which are, for example, edges and corners. They are certainly depending on the size, and what we found that optimal size for oxygen reduction reaction is 5 nanometers. And again, 5 nanometers more and more, I believe, is because it's a nice balance between activity and stability. I also mentioned in my first lecture that people are trying to impress the community with the effect of shape. Again, people are talking about different shapes and different, for example, activities and all of this. In our case, based on activity stability, it's clear that shape is just basically we can't monitor shape in the electrochemical environment. It's too harsh. This is what, for example, is our pristine, beautiful cube, certainly the representative, most likely the most beautiful one we found. And then after the experiment, you end up with this, for example, spherical. And this was only, I think, maybe 10 cycles. So how one can claim that he basically can follow the reaction, for example, on the cubes, being basically you have continuous shape. This is the same for octahedron. On the end, basically, you have very similar shape. So what we found with this experiment is that there is no particle shape effect. And I think, at least, I wouldn't waste time, at least for oxygen reduction and oxygen evolution, trying to understand how particle shape may affect kinetics. But what I would really try to understand is how to help platinum, because activity of platinum is not enough for fuel cells, for example, to become the reality. So we spent a lot of time learning how to help platinum by alloying, for example, with these 3D transition metals. And for example, in order to do this, again, we made first our sort of bulk electrodes. We use lead, we use ion scattering to see what is on the surface, for example, or lead, what is the structure of surface atoms. Then we use surface X-ray diffraction in situ to find, again, this nanosegregated profile. So nanosegregation is not really common only for ruthenium, iridium, but now you can see for platinum, nickel as well. After the annealing, for example, you make this what we call platinum skin, which is 100% platinum on the surface, and you have, for example, only 75% of platinum into the bulk. Now, again, talking about electronic properties, which a decade ago was something which everyone was obsessed with, we tried to make our volcanoes, for example, because we were able at ALS in Berkeley to measure really the D-band position. And based on the D-band position and activity of oxygen reduction, we created our own volcano curve. Now, on the top, it was usually platinum, nickel, and platinum cobalt. And what was unique, that these nano-segregated systems are absolutely hugely, we have huge improvement in activity comparing with platinum carbon. But again, to understand what is behind all of this, we start doing also with single crystals. We have all of this, we have single crystals. But I'm going to show you just for platinum nickel, because this is our story. With platinum nickel, and this is something what I show, we can follow segregation in situ, we can follow certainly voltammetry simultaneously, and we can follow oxygen reduction reaction. This is the activity on platinum. Keep in mind that, for example, what I like to do with platinum, to shift as much as possible towards 123 volts. And now, on platinum skin, basically you see you have this huge 50 millivolts is huge. It's really, for example, 100 times more inactivity. And this is what we observe for platinum 111. I have one slide, but I have to skip because of the time, to say why platinum 111. I was really puzzled for a long time why platinum 111 is so much more active than platinum 100. But both of them have almost identical the D-band center position. So it's not really just the D-band center, it's more than D-band center in order to understand how to design these materials. Now, this was somehow really our inspiration, as I said. This is now we know that, for example, if you made these nano-segregated profiles, you can really improve catalytic activity for the oxygen reduction reaction. And we did, for example, for many, many materials. I just started with cobalt. And these are our old work, actually, one of the, for maybe now, almost 10, 15 years old. We made actually platinum, nickel, cobalt. We use IDEX certainly to impress the reviewers to try to see that you have nickel and cobalt on the platinum and cobalt inside, but what else? Because you started with platinum and cobalt. But what was really very interesting, at least for me, is particle size effect. I think this is a little bit different than maybe in the battery system. For fuel cells, it's very important how big particles you have, for many reasons, for the loading, for example, but also The question is, can we optimize with the particle size activity? So with platinum cobalt we did, and we find that the optimum particle size is 5 nanometers. And although I said, for example, within for 10 seconds at 5 nanometers, lots of actually months we spent trying really to find these 5 nanometers based on platinum single crystals and this segregation induced formation of platinum skin. We then use the temperature in order, for example, for these pristine surfaces to make our nano-segregated systems. Once we have basically made this nano-segregated system, certainly then we try to learn how to basically what is happening once, for example, you immerse this in the electrochemical system. And certainly you have dealloying. And now we are monitoring this, for example, with our in-situ ICP-MS. It's really beautiful to follow how cobalt is dissolving and how basically the competition between the solution of platinum and cobalt. Now, again, just to finish, besides size, temperature, dealloying, it's very important to know what is the optimum ratio, for example, in order to make the best catalyst. And what we find, at least in our study, is 50-50. Now, certainly, whatever here is described for platinum cobalt, the same apply for platinum nickel. We start with the same pristine, and we end up with something what we call platinum skeleton. But now we have two platinum layers. This is something what I still don't understand. But this is based on EDEX measurement. This is clearly what we see. Now, besides, for example, certainly from the very beginning, I was thinking really not only how to make active, but how to stabilize these materials. And Radoslav Adžić from Berkeley, from Brookhaven National Lab, he was somehow trying to combine platinum and gold. And what he found with his very well-defined system, then when you add gold to platinum, then you stabilize. So what basically we mimic this, we made our sort of core shell structure with gold being a core and initially iron platinum shell. After the solution, you end up only with platinum. And what we found, if you would do experiments in fuel cells or in the lab with platinum, you would find, for example, that this small initially, for this is pristine sample. After the cycling, you see this also ripening. You see this huge, for example, change in the particle size, clearly indicating that the system is rather unstable. It's not so when you have gold in the core. After, before, and after, actually, the particle size and distribution is very, very similar. So this might be one way not only to catalyze the reaction, but also how to stabilize the reaction. Now, after this, certainly we move forward, and we somehow have very nice, at least we used to have very nice collaboration with 3M, which is specialized, for example, in making these nanostructured thin films. Now you can see mesostructure, nanostructure. Certainly, we are using all of this, either, for example, to ask DOE for more money, or really maybe to convince editor to publish our paper. But in fact, what we somehow really were trying to do with all of this is really to try to see, can we transfer the knowledge from single crystals to some real materials? So these are nanostructure, these are what 3M is calling the whiskers, which are decorated, for example, in this case with platinum nickel. And first, for example, they have beautiful method how to deposit all of this. Then they send us the sample. Then we use our annealing protocol. This is our trick, not to work immediately with pristine, but rather to anneal the sample. And then, for example, you start changing, if you like, the facets of these nano whiskers. And on the end, for example, at least one of my co-workers actually tried to convince me, and somehow on the end I give up, that this is somehow transition from nano to meso. I'm not certainly sure about this. I don't know if you, but I certainly cannot see almost or see very, very small difference between nano and meso. However, it might not be certainly structural difference, but as you are going to see, there is a big difference in catalytic activity. Now, from these meso thin films, somehow we really continue, and this is in collaboration with Berkeley, actually. We did, and we managed to create these nanoframes. Again, I'm not going to go through chemistry. This is just images showing basically that you can really start with this type of materials and to end up with somehow these cave-like nanoframes, for which are very well characterized, and not only very well characterized, but with unique activity. Now, I went very fast through all of this because I think this is something what I, at least I've been talking for a long time, how we can design oxygen reduction catalysts. So this is the summary. Absolutely champion for oxygen reduction reactions is platinum 3 nickel 111. And the last actually almost 15 years, I was trying very hard how basically to approach activity of platinum 3 nickel. And we started with our volcano. And then, for example, we made these sort of core shell structures. And then also we go through this meso. And now we are with our, for example, nanoframes. Certainly, we are still far away from platinum 3 nickel activity. But at least we are going in positive direction. I don't know. Maybe only what basically I would like to understand. Certainly, I have no much more time in front of me to try to climb even further. But what at least I wanted to know is why and what is unique activity of platinum 3 nickel 111. I have a slide, but I'm afraid I'm going to skip this because I have no time. The only trick is that basically the unique, and this is again our ICP-MS methods, that simultaneously one can follow oxygen reduction reaction, stability of platinum, and stability of nickel. And long story to make, for example, to summarize, is that this time activity and stability are going in the same direction. It's completely different than for oxygen evolution reaction. And more stable is more active. So it's not really true that the balance is always stability and activity, but also you have to find sort of the system and to understand when activity and stability are going in the same direction. So all of this, what I was discussing, was really somehow trying to change the electronic properties of nanoparticles and how these electronic properties may affect activity and stability of my system. Last week, I think we had very nice, at least I attended very nice seminar on somehow selectivity. And that's the reason why I like to close my lecture today, simply by mentioning that certainly changing or manipulating with activity is not enough, at least not for fuel cells reactions. So what we better try to do, is it possible somehow to keep the same electronic properties and somehow to change activity, if you like, by molecular patterning? And this is part, big part of selectivity. And this is very important for many reactions in fuel cells. Now, I'm going to show two examples. One, for example, for phosphoric acid fuel cells. The problem for phosphoric acid fuel cells is really on platinum is that you can contaminate with absorption, oxygen reduction reaction with absorption of spectator species like phosphoric acid anions. So the key question was, for example, is it possible to design sort of the interface, if you like, or if it's possible to design selectivity of the interface to allow oxygen to come in, but somehow to not allowing very poisonous phosphoric acid anion to come on. And this is going to be one example. The second example, sort of, and this is certainly I'm going to discuss this in the sense of competition, for example, between small oxygen and big phosphoric acid anions. Also, in fuel cells, is very important for those who at least know something about fuel cells, is that because of the crossover on the anode side, you may have a problem for oxygen reduction reaction. Now, why is this happening is not important, but certainly the key is, for example, and we were somehow trying to see, is it possible selectively to make also membranes in a such a way which would allow hydrogen to go in, but now to expel oxygen from the interface? Let me start very briefly, for example, first with phosphoric acid. Now, this is voltammetry, and I'm not going to discuss science. I'm just going to give you the flavor. These are the activity. You can see activity in phosphoric acid. Keep in mind, this is the reversible potential. is very sluggish. It's very slow because the surface is completely covered with these phosphoric acid anions. However, once I put, for example, my cyanide on the surface, then basically you see a huge shift in catalytic activity. So now, even in phosphoric acid environment, what you can see, activity between perchloric acid, which is non-specifically absorbing electrolyte, and phosphoric acid is absolutely the same. So this is, I think, this is really one of the best examples showing that somehow one can really selectively, for example, change interface in a such a way to allow only reaction which we would like to take place to come and to basically take place on the surface. And I think, certainly, again, all of this, one can make a big story about the electronic effect of cyanide on absorption intermediates. In our case, basically, we start to simplify and to say everything is really dependent on the spectator coverage. It's not only OH, but also on the coverage of anions present in the electrolyte. The second example, as I said now, is competition between oxygen and hydrogen. It was much more difficult to design this because both are very, very small. I was somehow, when I was thinking about this, I got a visitor, actually. He is an organic chemist, very good one. And basically, we were discussing about this, and he designed this calixerin type of membranes. And basically, what I was very pleased when, for example, because he was trying to tell me that depending on the size of this cone, maybe oxygen and hydrogen can compete, for example, for the surface site. And this was indeed true. Look at, for the surface which is covered with this calixerin, actually, you see that free platinum without any organic molecules on the surface and platinum covered with them, hydrogen reaction is absolutely the same, no change. Now, this is activity for platinum on pure platinum, or oxygen on pure platinum, but this is activity when it's covered with these calixerins. So I think it's clear that you can basically selectively just, for example, have one reaction comparing to the other. And what was even more beautiful, I think, is that somehow we managed to go from single crystal all the way down to real nanoparticles. So it is really possible, based, again, on model system, to design real nanoparticles. Now, I don't think that I'm going to talk about this, but just to mention that certainly we use all of this also for the Nafion, because Nafion is a true membrane. Nafion is separator in the fuel cells. And I think the big question for Nafion was sort of, does Nafion interact with platinum? This is one. The second, how Nafion, if interact with platinum, is affecting oxygen reduction reaction, because this is the key part. Certainly, Nafion is used to allow, for example, proton to go through. And in order to do this, again, in order to understand the Nafion, for example, again, we started with platinum-111. And then we find a way how to basically modify platinum-111 with Nafion. And again, I am not going to go through voltammetry because I would need 5 minutes to go through all of this. But just to tell you that what we found, if you see this red peak here, this is the signature, for example, for sulfonate, this anion's absorption. How we know this? Because if you do pure platinum with sulfuric acid, you see in the same potential region the peak. Certainly much smaller peak because interaction is much weaker, for example, with sulfonic acid anions than sulfuric acid anions. This is one thing he's telling me, told us at least, that Nafion interact with platinum. But the second thing is also, look at now, this is in perchloric acid. This is OH absorption. If you cover the surface with Nafion, you see this shift in OH. That means your surface is poisoned. So it is indeed that Nafion interacts with platinum nanoparticles. If you would do now oxygen reduction reaction, not surprisingly, you would find, for example, that this is small, it's 20 millivolts, but in catalysis, 20 millivolts is huge. You have this shift. So it is indeed that Nafion is affecting oxygen reduction reaction. This is when you do in perchloric acid, certainly when you do in sulfuric acid, where you have this absorption of sulfuric acid, you see no difference. because this is something basically sulfonic anions cannot compete with sulfuric acid anions. So based on all of this, I think at least I was trying today somehow to give you again just a flavor of oxygen and the flavor of activity and stability for oxygen evolution reaction. I try really to give you more just really a story how we are developing catalysts, for example, for oxygen reduction reaction. But not only via electronic, but also through selectivity, actually, of electrochemical interfaces. And let me very briefly conclude, actually. This is, again, I think the key is our approach. I wouldn't give up. I can't give up on many things, but not on our surface science approach. And I think this is also something what at least I would like to see in the battery field more and more. And I'm very encouraged, actually, what I'm seeing here. Now, what basically we have? We have oxygen evolution reaction, all of these activity, stability relationships. Basically, we also were capable somehow to design a new iridium, ruthenium alloy for oxygen evolution reaction. We are capable now to follow in situ activity and stability of different components. Certainly now we are doing V3 components. It's even much more exciting because then you can follow three components, for example, stability and simultaneously activity. I was saying, for example, this is at least what I would like to continue with. What is unique with these 3D oxides? Why they are stable on the surface, although you have only two atomic layers? How really substrate is affecting the stability? And certainly, what is unique with these electrochemically created hydroxyoxides? Now, I think this is our, let's say, first work with perovskites. This is, at least to my knowledge, the first single crystal actually approach demonstrated that activity and stability are controlled by the density of defects on the surface. This is, again, our nanoframes. Keep in mind that selectivity is something what everyone should actually pay attention for, not only, for example, for with inorganics, but also organic membrane types. And again, somehow one, I didn't have time to talk about the Nafion, but the Nafion actually itself is operating through all of this somehow a synergy between covalent and non-covalent interface. And this is exactly what I would like to dedicate my last lecture. Somehow, what about oxygen and water, which I spent lots of time, for example, during these three lectures, how these, for example, are behaving in organic environments. And with this, I think I would like to thank you once more, to thank my people, and to conclude my talk. Thank you very much.